Good afternoon. Welcome to the Center for Great Plains Studies Olson Seminar Series. We continue this afternoon the series that we began earlier in the semester on themes which were related to the symposium which we held some 10 days ago. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to ask Museum Administrator and Curator Amber Moore to tell us about some of the artwork we're seeing around us. Amber?
Thank you, Rick. I'd also like to add my welcome on behalf of the Great Plains Art Museum. As Rick mentioned, I want to tell you a little bit about the artwork you see around you, and that's in our lower level gallery. On the Lentz Gallery on the lower level, we continue confrontations and conciliatory acts, art and artifacts of U.S. and Sioux Nation conflict. Of course, we know besides the passage of the Morrill Act in 1862, there was also the Great Sioux Uprising, which certainly led to great changes on the Great Plains region. And some of our artwork and loans from Morrill Hall are exhibited on the lower level. Right here around you in our Chris Sleep Gallery, you'll see artworks from a collaborative exhibition and program done in Omaha between Thurman Statham Glasswork Studio, Hot Shops, Kaneko, and Omaha Public Schools Native American Education Program. Students between the ages of 8 and 21 worked throughout the summer with Thurman Statham to learn more about their individual tribal heritage and create artworks that expressed their cultural identity. And in our South and West galleries, for the ninth year, we exhibit Lincoln Public Schools Visual Arts Mentoring Program exhibition. These are students, kindergarten through sixth grade, talented in the visual arts, who apply for a program and get partnered with an artist mentor in the community. They work on this artwork as an extracurricular, and they get a chance to exhibit it for 2.5 weeks at the Great Plains Art Museum. These will continue until April 24th. Thank you.
Thanks, Amber. I will continue to follow my predecessor Jim Stubendick's rule about brief introductions today. You know, there's a second Stubendick rule, which is no colons in academic titles. This is an almost impossible rule to enforce. And I just want to congratulate our speaker today for no colon in his title. I mean, amazing. Anyway, today's Olson Lecture is Ed Harvey, Professor of Hydrological Sciences in the School of Natural Resources here at UNL, and he's a research hydrologist with the Nebraska Conservation and Survey Division. Why, then, would we ask him to speak on Justin Morrill? Well, some years ago, Ed was asked to lead the Justin Morrill Scholars Program and Learning Community here at UNL, and that was an inspired choice. Among others, it inspired Ed to become what he describes as an ever-learning student of the land-grant system and of Justin Morrill. Ed and his wife Carol have just returned from several months in Holland on part of a project of the Water for Food initiative here, and he's just back, probably still suffering from some jet lag. I don't know. We'll see. But we're delighted that he's here in any event. Professor Harvey's talk today is called Reflections on the Morrill Act and the Man for Whom It's Named, no colon. Ed, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I like to wander when I talk, so if that's okay, I'll walk around a bit. There we go. As Rick said, this is a hobby with me more than it is an expertise, and I'm not apologizing, but I will tell you up front, if you came expecting to hear me expound upon where I think the land grants should go in the future and things like that, while I have opinions on that, that's not what you're going to hear today. We've heard a lot of that in the past couple of weeks with the symposium and other events around the celebration across the United States, but it strikes me as I interact with people that while most people know what a land grant is or know what the act was, might even know the author's name, they don't really know much about the history of the land-grant process itself. So what I want to do today is reflect back on a little bit of that to talk specifically about how the Land-Grant Act came to be, and then also to talk a little bit about what might have inspired it. We'll start with just this photograph of the Morrill Homestead in Stratford, Vermont, with Justin Morrill sitting over here. This is the gentleman who wrote, at least as history gives him credit for, he wrote the Land-Grant Act. His wife, Ruth, their dog, Trump, the son, James, and Ruth's sister, Louise, who lived with him for quite a while, taking care of her and the family. And we'll come back to this little town a little later as we talk about the inspiration. If you've not seen it, this is the Morrill Land Grant Act that was passed in 1862 and signed by Abraham Lincoln. If you can't read this, which I don't expect you to, it's also over here in the framed pictures on my right. You're welcome to walk by and look at those. Those stay on the wall outside of my office normally, and I use them as a teaching tool to instruct my students on what the Land Grant Act is, and to help them, you know, work through the process of learning about Justin Morrill. I'm curious, how many of you have actually ever seen the Land Grant Act before? Anyone? Anyone ever seen the actual Land Grant? Okay, the Land Grant Act was actually on display in Iowa at Iowa State a number of years ago for their anniversary, and I went over to see it, and I'll speak a little bit more about that a little bit later. But most of us have never seen it. How many of you have read it? Okay, a few. You guys can't ask me any really tough questions because so most people haven't read it either. So hopefully this talk will be aimed at you, and you'll like what I have to present. The first thing that struck me when I began looking into the Land Grant Act and studying Morrill and getting ready for my students and such was how short it is. You remember how big the document was we just passed for the health care bill? Well, that we heard about on TV every day, thousands of pages, and a lot of these other bills are thousands of pages. The Morrill Act was 3 pages, and you'll see a bit later on, there's really only a little paragraph that matters to us. The rest of it was sort of legal and procedural. So we'll come back to that. But that was the first thing that impressed me, was how simple it was, and from such a simple document came what we have today as a very complex and vastly important and impressive system that has changed education. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as well. But as I said, the talk is going to be a little bit about the Land Grant Act, but also about something else. I want to just throw these up so you know that I am aware of the comments that have been made. I mean, this act has been absolutely groundbreaking, earth-shattering, life-changing. And a lot of people have said a lot of nice things about it. Interestingly enough, most of these seem to be university presidents. But you can read them for yourself. I'll leave here for a second. The most recent one you saw, if you went to the symposium, Martin Jiske, I believe is how he pronounces his name, he has been a more recent proponent of speaking on the importance of the Land Grant College Act, as well as the GI Bill and some other legislation, and he's also one of the visionary leaders who's been looking into the future about what we can do and how the Land Grant Act should evolve and what's the next steps. So there's been a lot done about this. This is a very important document. It strikes me that many of you may not realize that at the time it was written, basically the beginning of the Civil War conflict was when it was written and passed, and it was also passed at a time when a lot of other legislation was being put through the Congress, as well as signed in those days around the signing date of this act by Abraham Lincoln. So we sometimes tend to think of it as this sort of standalone thing that occurred as this grandiose moment, but in many ways it was at the time an important document, but sort of just another thing that they were doing in Congress to move the country forward. And it turns out that it has, I think in some cases, much bigger reach and broader ramifications than perhaps its author even envisioned when he wrote the document. If you don't get a chance to read all these, that's okay. They're just more or less to illustrate the point. Now, for this particular talk, I think when I was asked to provide an abstract, this is what I included. So I will try to stay focused on this throughout the talk and make sure we do answer these actual questions. The main thing I want to talk about today, after I give you a little bit of background on the Morrill Act itself, is to talk about the inspiration. And this is the part that I deal with more than I do the actual act, because I spend most of my time studying Justin Morrill, learning about Justin Morrill, and using Justin Morrill's life to teach my students leadership, civic engagement, lifelong learning, and all the various tenets and traits that Morrill embodied and had in his life. So we're going to focus a little bit more at the end on Morrill to specifically look at the questions. Now, the words in italics are taken right from the act, and we'll see those again a little bit later. But basically, the question I wanted to ask, or I hope we can answer by the time we get finished, is to put you in a position where you will understand what inspired Justin Morrill to write this act, and secondly, why at this particular time in history would this store owner from Vermont care enough to go and write this act or do this, okay? So the purpose of the talk is somewhat to educate you about the Morrill Act. It's more, for my sake, the purpose to educate you about Justin Morrill, the man, and what he was thinking and how he came to write this act, because that, to me, is where the interesting personal side of this lies. As you may already know as well, I mean, this came about at a time when a lot of people were talking about education, but even since the beginning of the country, we began to have discussions and conversations, and Jefferson himself actually made comments about the importance of education in forming a new democracy. The idea basically was democracy will not work if you do not have an educated populace who can know the issues, can vote accordingly, and make the decisions that make the country go. So even early on, we began to have conversations or hear in the Founding Fathers' comments the idea that education would be something that all Americans should be entitled to and that we should find ways to make that happen. Now, the first true mention of agricultural colleges, or the beginnings of them, has been attributed or credited to Simeon DeWitt in 1819. There were actually agricultural colleges at the time in Europe, in France and England specifically, and Morrill and others were aware of them. There were also a few in the United States. The Michigan State was formerly a Michigan Agricultural College that was already teaching agriculture before the Land-Grant Act was written, as was the University of New York and a few others. But it really was starting to get some ground after this when people started to look at not just education in a broad sense, as Jefferson had mentioned, but specifically teaching skills that were practical to farmers, to people who were on the fields, and bringing education to the common person. And I like the comment here. I get such a kick out of the historical titles of a lot of these. And again, I'm not going to read it to you, but my favorite is, "And having more children of wealthy citizens educated for the profession of farming." That must have been some pamphlet, okay? I think about the comment in the video that was made about the University of Nebraska when they said something about, you know, these gentlemen farmers coming out here to try to teach us how to farm, and it's the same kind of thing, teaching the rich kids how to be farmers. Interesting concept. This continued throughout the time leading up to when Morrill penned the act, and you can see some others here. First mention of School of Agricultural Mechanics, and another one I get a kick out of, and Useful Arts. We shouldn't create a school with unuseful arts, but I suppose the useful arts was kind of interesting. John Skinner, who may or may not know, was an agricultural publisher, published one of the first ag journals in the United States, and went on to publish actually several more of different names. He was petitioning Congress, actually, for subsidies, the first real interaction with the congressional delegations to try to get money to fund these. Now, the big player that everybody knows outside of Morrill, and the player that's sort of some controversy, which I will not go into today, but we'd be happy to discuss with you afterwards if you'd like. But in 1850, an Illinois professor named Jonathan Baldwin Turner proposed the idea of a university for the industrial classes. Now, this may not be a big distinction, but industrial is somewhat different than agricultural, was what some of the historians look at as a way to differentiate what they had done. But he was quite the proponent of this and became very active in promoting the idea of educating the industrial classes, such that the Illinois State Legislature actually sent Congress resolutions requesting money to build these endow these systems. So this is sort of what some people think is the birth of the real idea of an agricultural college that would be across the United States in different places for the educating of the populace. Well, along comes Justin Morrill. Now, as I said, there's some controversy, but most historians agree that Justin Morrill penned the original act and shepherded it all the way through Congress and became his champion. And throughout his career, despite having lots of other activities in Congress and actually being probably known at the time more for other bills that he had pushed forward and other activities in Congress, he was the absolute champion of this act until literally the day he died. He was a congressman from Stratford, Vermont. Anyone been to Stratford, Vermont? Good. Well won. Okay. You'll see some photos later. He took office in December of 1885. And again, he authored not only the 1862 Act, but he's also the author of the 1890 Act, which would later go on to create colleges that would allow African Americans to go to school in the southern states that would not allow them into the other land-grant universities. I'm not going to talk a lot about that today, but it's clearly a very important part of this. And he got that act actually passed through Congress as well in 1890. Now, thinking back to the origins, Morrill himself commented on where he got this idea. And again, this relates somewhat to the controversy that I'm not talking about. But He basically stated that he started forming this idea about 1856. He was obviously gathering information from others talking about it, about the European schools. You see from what I talk about at the end, his inspiration came very much from his own home and his own background, his own upbringing. But clearly this was in the media of the time or in the discussions of the time. So it's probably not fair to credit the entire idea to Justin Morrill, but Justin Morrill formalized it into a document that actually passed through Congress, and for that reason he's given credit for the Land-Grant Act. He himself, though, says where he obtained the hint of such a measure, he's wholly unable to say. So he didn't really remember what inspired him, but you'll see, I think, as we get near the end of the talk, he'd been inspired since the day he was born to write the Land-Grant College Act. So let's look, if you don't mind me walking you through history a little bit. I realize slides with text on them are a little boring, so I've added a few photos to try to brighten them up. We'll not hit every bullet exactly, but I want you to get a feel for this, and there's a reason I'm doing this besides just telling you the history. But on February 28, 1856, Morrill makes a first attempt at a Land-Grant College Act. Okay? Now, the first thing he did was to ask for the establishment of this agricultural board and also looking at sort of national agricultural schools, much like the military academies at Annapolis and West Point. His idea was that we would create an ag school that then congressmen and senators would pick representatives from their district and send those students in the same way they do the military schools to attend for agricultural reasons. And this, of course, was immediately voted down in committee and never even got out for discussion. They did away with it pretty quickly. And so it didn't go on. But at least at this point in his life, he was starting to think about this, and we were starting to have this thought. of a school for this purpose. But you'll notice that at this point, this thought was still of a national university, much the same way that the European universities had national universities. This first concept was sort of that step. Now, as I was preparing for this, and I borrowed the picture from this, any of you remember the little, something rocks, I forget, Schoolhouse Rock with the I'm Just a Bill? This is how I learned how Congress worked when I was a young boy watching television. So I'm going to follow the same steps here. He's just a bill. He's only a bill. But Morrill introduced the bill that he called the Bill for Granting Lands for Agricultural Colleges on December 17th in 1857. Morrill was on the Ag Committee, and he cleverly motioned to have this bill sent to the Ag Committee for its initial review. But quickly, another person jumped up, the Virginian, and he proposed that it go to the Committee on Public Lands. And they agreed to do that, and they sent the committee, or Letcher's motion carried, and it went to the Committee on Public Lands. Now, the reason this is important is because much of the discussion and debate against the Morrill Act early on had a great deal to do with this idea of the land grant part of it, as far as granting lands, the idea of speculation, and some of the other things that people were opposed to, and the constitutionality of whether this was actually a legal thing to do, despite the fact that the government had already looked into railroads and looked at the veterans and other people were getting lands were being sold accordingly. This was a controversial part of the bill. It would be interesting to know what would have happened had this gone through agriculture first, but we'll never know that. All right, so it stayed in committee for a while. This is where the little bill guy is sitting outside the door. And then the chair Cobb actually reported the bill out of committee on April 15th, recommending that it be rejected. Okay. Morrill and his supporters, primarily Walbridge of Michigan and Washburn of Maine, maneuvered, as most politicians know how to do very well, to keep the measure before the House. Now, this was actually an early piece of legislation for Morrill, but it was not his first. His first actually had been an act related to polygamy, and he hadn't done so well with it. So he'd learned from this mistake and got better at this, the way parliamentarians maneuver. And I don't want to go into all the details of how they did it with the standing and motioning and passing and doing, taking the floor and doing whatever, but ultimately they worked it out so that Morrill was able to stand up and amend his own bill with an amendment that was basically the bill, and this then allowed him to give a speech before Congress proposing or supporting the new amendment, which was really to support the bill, and so it allowed him to give this speech. And so the next morning he came forward and gave what is his first impassioned speech about the Morrill Act. And you can download this from the archives, and I have a copy if anybody's curious. But it's a very interesting speech. I won't go through the entire thing. We certainly won't read it aloud to you. But Morrill went through a series of discussions that highlighted the things I have here. First, he talked about the constitutionality of the measure, making a case for the fact that this has been done before with lands. This is no different. This is no things we create. So it's a very constitutional bill. Second, he talked about America's declining agricultural productivity, and he used numbers and facts to show the sequence of years of production in various aspects of agriculture that had been going down in the United States, and also he had been comparing them to the European systems, which had been actually prospering very much, okay, making the case for the fact that this decline, he felt, was essentially caused by the lack of knowledge on the part of the farmers for taking care of the land, rejuvenating the land, planting efficient crop returns and things like that. So he was focusing specifically on that. Then he made the statement, which I put in because I find it really interesting. He began talking about the schools as just sort of the right thing to do. And I will read you this one because I think it's fun. But we have schools to teach the art of manslaying. When's the last time you used that word in a conversation? Okay? Manslaying and make masters of deep-throated engines of war, remembering that the Civil War is at hand. And shall we not have schools to teach men the way to feed, clothe, and enlighten the great brotherhood of man? And here comes that philosophy or that mentality again of the democratization of education in the United States, that we need something that educates man to be better, okay, to be more educated, to be more informed, and everyone has that right. And lastly, he went over the discussion of the sale of public lands, noting other lands had been sold, kind of giving him a feel for how much would be involved here, making the case that there really wasn't that much land and things would be okay. And so he gave this speech, and Cobb quickly jumped up to speak against the bill, but the motion failed to return to committee. There was some more filibustering and delays, which I won't bore you with five or six more slides that I could obviously put on here if I listed them all. But finally, this bill passed in 105 to 100. That's a pretty narrow margin. Okay, barely got it through, but he got it through. So the bill moved to the upper house, where it was sponsored first by Michigan Senator Charles Stewart, who was not that great a senator and didn't really do a good job with getting it going. So it was taken over by Benjamin Wade of Ohio, and Benjamin Wade nursed it and shepherded it through the remainder of the Senate, and would ultimately go on to be the second, when the next act would come along, as you'll see in a minute, he was also a part of that as well. Now, As the bill is being discussed, Southerners, as you might imagine, were quite opposed to this based on constitutionality. The South had a real problem with the idea of the government selling land and using money and having a hand in what was going on, and they were very much against this bill from a constitutionality standpoint. The Western states were the ones that were concerned about land speculation. And why would that be? Well, because that's where all the land was. So Kansas and others particularly had problems with this bill because they felt like it would allow all these land people to come in, buy up all the good lands, and then sell them at a big profit, and the states would lose the land. And remember, at the same time, and we've learned about this in the last couple of weeks, we also had bills being discussed, assumedly at the same time, on Railroad Act, other things. All these various different bills were grabbing land, in a sense, or using public land. So there's a lot of concern about that from the Westerners. But Wade managed to push it through, and they voted, and the measure, with two minor amendments, passed 25 to 22. Those amendments went back to the House. They approved it 148 to 95 on February 16th, and the bill was sent to President James Buchanan to be signed into law. And so the first Morrill Act was born, and right here we would have had the creation of the land-grant universities, except for the fact that Buchanan vetoed the bill. Okay, Buchanan was a Southerner, he was a Southern sympathizer, and the congressional delegation from the South got to him and convinced him that this was an unconstitutional bill and that he should veto it, and he did. So the Morrill Act, the land, as he called it at that time, the college land bill, was dead. Or was it? There was a wind blowing out in the West and in the country, and a man, Abraham Lincoln, was coming up from Illinois to become the next president. At the time the first Morrill Act was vetoed, there were 13 states across the country that wanted this, and they had encouraged their delegations and their legislation to approve this if it ever came up again. So this reminds me of another recent series of events in the United States where the people wanted something, but the politicians just didn't seem to hear it. Okay, so the people wanted this bill. And so Morrill waited, and he knew that Lincoln would be more favorable to it. Some people consider that because Lincoln was from Illinois and Turner was from Illinois, that there had been some conversations already happened, that perhaps Lincoln was already in favor of this type of an act from his interacting with the University of Illinois, which was not called that at the time, Illinois College. But so there might have been some pre-knowledge in Lincoln's mind. I won't get into that debate either. But when they got this thing started, Lincoln came in. There were pressing Civil War matters, so Morrill could not submit the bill right away. Okay, they had to worry about funding the war and paying for a lot of other things that were going on, so it sat for a time. But Morrill watched and waited, and then on December 16th, when he was ready, he resubmitted this bill, slightly modified, back to the House again. Okay, second try. Now, I'm telling you the story in part to tell you that one of the things I teach my students that they can learn from Justin Morrill is patience and a certain amount of stubbornness to not give up on your dream. Okay, and Morrill clearly did not. Now, Morrill made some changes, and these are very important changes in some cases, the first one being, you'll see this again, and I realize you haven't seen it. Morrill added the phrase, without excluding other scientific and classical studies to the bill. This, to me, was a very important phrase, which I'll talk about a little bit later, that changed this bill from being just about ag schools and really made it about educating Americans, real Americans, grassroots, down-home Americans, in any of the pursuits of science, arts, literature, etc., not just on an agricultural campus. He did include, in addition to agriculture on this particular bill, the mechanical arts. This is the birth of what we know today as engineering, being taught in universities. He increased the land allotment, which is not as big a deal to us, but mattered to others. And he also included a provision for teaching military tactics. Historians suspect that he did this as a political move because the North was losing a lot of battles at this point and couldn't get generals to lead. Lincoln was having fits with his generals. So the idea was, well, we'll put this in so it'll encourage the Northern senators to vote for this in light that they'll be able to train more military leaders at these universities as well. And thus, the M portion of A&M's were born as well in this bill. It also excluded the territories with an exception that's in a clause that we won't forget about, and it excluded the rebelling states. Remember, at the time when the southern states were voting to secede, and there was a feeling that if this was in, it would draw more northern support as well. Plus, as you'll see, when they voted on this, the southern states weren't even there. All right, back it goes. Here we go again. Now, you all feel like the guy on the left, okay? I'll go through this fairly quickly. Basically, we had a few of these things where it went through again, did not pass, committee started stalling. But again, now Morrill has learned the lesson. He's a clever man now. He's a better senator or better congressman because of it. So during this long delay, while the House is debating this in committee, Morrill has his friend, Mr. Wade, submit it to the Senate. So now it's in two places simultaneously. One's debating, spinning here. The other one's moving it through. And ultimately, the bill came back to the House from the Senate, was where it had its origin in the final version. Okay, again, the Westerners opposed it for the same reasons, but Iowa Senator James Harlan stepped up and said, well, we can make an amendment to fix that, and he limited the land availability in one state to 1 million. Very quickly, Wade accepted this proposal to his amendment. They voted, they got the thing to pass 32-7, and the Senate essentially passed the bill. It came back to the House, where Morrill stood up and said, fellas, we've been talking about this for 5 years. You already know about this bill. There's no reason to discuss this or debate anymore. Let's just do this thing and get it over with. I'm paraphrasing. Okay. But ultimately, that's what happened. His colleagues pushed it forward. There were some, again, stalling and scheduling, debating, like there always is in Congress. But ultimately, they voted in 90-25, passed this measure. And then the bill was sent on to President Lincoln, who signed it into law on July 2, 1862. And thus, we have the anniversary that we're celebrating this year. Okay. So here begins the birth of the land-grant university system. It took 5 years. Morrill never gave up on it. Okay, this could have been one of those ideas that a congressman had, like so many we see. It goes through, doesn't get passed, and they forget about it, and it sits around until somebody else comes and takes it up. But Morrill made this his passion, and he pushed it, and he made sure it went through. So much for the review. I bring you now to the most important part. As I said, this document, I'll go back real quick here, but this document, 3 pages, much of it, in the preamble gives a little bit of intro, but much of this has to do all the way down into here with essentially the land portion, how many acres, how it's going to be divvied up, the fact that states can't own other land than other states, and all these kinds of political and legal documents. But right smack in the middle of this page right here is the important phrases we're going to see in just a second that really mean the most to us, I think, philosophically, as well as how it changed the course of education. Now, I mentioned that I went to Iowa State to see this document a number of years ago. It was brought to Iowa State as part of their anniversary, and they paid a huge amount of money to bring it from Washington. It came in a truck, and it was just like some of the movies where you see there were actually 3 trucks. One went to Iowa State, 2 went somewhere else. They were sort of, they left Washington hiding which truck had it. It was on display in a case that was humidity controlled, temperature controlled, light controlled, hermetically sealed, all the other things for 10 or 16 some thousands of dollars to build this thing. And I went over excited to see this because I'm a bit of a zealot, admittedly. And I walked in and I looked down and I thought, there's only 2 pages here. What happens is this page is actually on the backside of this page. So when they displayed it in the case, you could see this page and this page with Lincoln's signature. And I thought it was ironic that the most important part of this document, no one could see. Well, you can see it today. It's right over there. But here's what it says. Those of us from East Campus know it from right here. When John Owens was the Vice Chancellor, he wrote on the doors of all the buildings on East Campus, the leading object. And as soon as he did it, most of us walked around saying, what in the world does the leading object mean? Okay. He also created a newsletter in the same way, but this comes from this paraphrase right here from the middle of the page 2 in section 4 of the Act. And again, I probably should just read this one to you. You can read it for yourself. I won't read the whole thing. But the basic part up here was that this was to endow and support the management or maintenance of these colleges, one college in each state, where the leading object, okay, or the main focus, if you want to put it in our modern words, shall be. Now notice, this is an important part for me. Comma. It does not say shall be, skip down to agriculture or mechanic art. It says shall be without excluding other scientific and classical studies and including military tactics, clever, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts in such manner as the legislatures of the states may respectively prescribe. Another important phrase. This phrase moves us from the national ag university concept of Europe to saying the states can do whatever they want with this setup and create their own land-grant colleges in whatever fashion they want to allow them to make the most effective use of the money and of the education. We'll see how that changed here in just a minute for all the different states. In order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes on the several pursuits and professions of life. That's a pretty big statement, rather than just saying, let's create some ag schools. Okay? I would not tell the story of certain people in the room, but I look around the room and I think I'm safe. Years ago, I won't name any names, but years ago when I was involved in a committee meeting of some kind, I actually heard an administrator at UNL, and I'm not trying to discredit the administrator in any way, I just was surprised by the comment, make a comment to his faculty that something to do with a program that was happening on the East Campus, but it probably won't impact us because we're not part of the land-grant mission. This shocked me because I thought, we're all part of the land-grant mission because I view the land-grant mission as being this other part, okay? Teach the industrial classes, scientific, classical studies, these other things are included. The land-grant mission is bigger than just an ag college, okay? At least it is to me. And I think sometimes we forget that, but they didn't. And Morrill certainly didn't. Morrill created land-grant colleges to educate the industrial classes on whatever subject they were interested in, and to teach ag and mechanical arts. But it was not specifically his goal in this document to just make ag schools. So the idea that your ag school is somewhere on the other side of campus, or your ag school is a different political, whatever, is simply fatuous. Now, in some states where they have an ag college separate from their major university, that may be more of a way it works out. But at this university, we're both. We're all in one. And so the art teacher, the English teacher, the business college, they are all part of the land-grant mission, in my opinion, to educate the industrial classes of Nebraska so that they may enjoy the pursuits and professions of life. Okay? And that may very well then include ag and mechanical arts. But anyway, you can see for yourself how it was born. Lots of different little things in these phrases. And what's amazing to me is that this little short paragraph, in the midst of all those 3 pages of legal jargon, created what we have today with its vision, its broad-reaching impact, and its flexibility to grow and do new things. And it's just amazing to me, given Congress, that they got it right that quickly in such a small piece of paper. Okay? But that's what it is. That's how it works. So that's us. Okay, enough of my pontificating. The land-grant colleges began, just to give you some examples, this is by no means all of them, but some of them were actually put in part as the first state university. So Minnesota, Wisconsin, Missouri, Wyoming, they used the land-grant money to create their first state university. And again, this goes back to the fact that the states were allowed to do this however they wanted to. Others created a separate state institution, like Colorado State, Iowa State, Kansas State, Michigan State, Texas A&M, you get the idea. So they created a separate place. Still others kind of did an agricultural mechanical college, which would one day become the state university. And here's where you recognize a familiar name, as well as MIT, Massachusetts, Ohio, West Virginia, and others. And finally, Illinois and Arkansas opted to create industrial universities. They were less focused at the time on agriculture as much as they were focused on industrial pursuits and training industrial class people. So they would eventually evolve into more of the ag colleges as well. But this was sort of the 4 ways it was started, and they began. Today, if you haven't seen this map before, we have 104 total. These are only the 1862s. 1890 would add some more in the south, and in the Native American schools would join, I believe, in 94, and then most of them are focused out in the northwest. But these are the land-grant colleges that would spring up from this 1862 act. Every state has one, territories in some cases as well. Okay, so if you don't know what they are, there they are. So it's a pretty broad-reaching act today. At the time, I'm still not convinced, though people tell me in talks all the time, I'm not convinced that the people who wrote this act, Justin Morrill and his colleagues, quite envisioned what we have today. I certainly think they had a broader vision for education in America, and I certainly think they were the first ones to put that vision into play. But my guess is they would be amazed if they saw what we have today, with 104 institutions, millions of graduates, dominant research programs across the globe. It's an impressive outcome to a piece of legislation that is essentially this big. All right, back to my original point of the talk, though. So we have this system. Well, what inspired it? All right, what I want to do with the remainder of the talk, trying to watch my time here, is to take you on a little journey to the little town of Stratford, Vermont, where Justin Morrill is from, and let you see what he experienced and went through in order to create in him the desire and the interest to formulate the Land-Grant College Act. So that we can answer these questions. What inspired this new system? Okay, and at the time the country was at war, what were we thinking to do this? All right, this is Justin Morrill. To transition to my next slide, I'll look at the Morrill biographer himself, who wrote William Parker, the biographer. This biography is out of print, but if anyone's interested, it is in the library, and I have been buying up copies on the internet for the last 5 years, so I have a very large collection of these books, to my wife's chagrin. But anyway, Morrill basically, according to the biographer Parker, to get to know Morrill and to get to know what his rationale was and his thinking was and his impassioned inspiration was, you have to go back and be with him in the small village he grew up in the church he attended, in the store he worked in the garden he worked in the back of his house. So that's what we're going to do, if you'll allow me to do. I take the students here every year. We go to Vermont on a pilgrimage, if you will, to the Morrill Homestead, where we do a service learning project at the homestead. We meet the people, we talk with historians, we visit the sites, tour the homestead, sit in the very chair, they don't though, in his office, in where he, you see all these things. So it really puts the students in the spirit of Justin Morrill's home, and in his inspiration comes out. And they are all inspired by it, which is amazing to me that 19 and 20-year-old students would be inspired by historical building in the middle of the Vermont hills. But it's his work. It's been really nice. So if you don't know Vermont very well, this is Burlington. Here you see the state. This little area right in here is where the little town of Stratford is. Stratford is actually two little towns. Today it's South Stratford and Stratford. At the time it was just this upper village, lower village of Stratford. This is the upper village. Just an air photo to sort of give you a feel for the landscape. Obviously, today there are a lot more trees than there were in Vermont. At the time of the Civil War, Vermont had very few trees. They'd been all basically cut down to fuel fires and build houses and do other things. And so over the past years of our lifetime, the trees have come back to Vermont. But at the time Morrill was there, it was probably much more of a desolate environment with a lot of fields, a lot of sheep grazing around. Textiles were big here, a lot of farming. Okay, and this is the little town of Stratford. If you drive in now along this road, this is now Justin Morrill Highway. But it's a quaint little place. If those of you know the Bob Newhart show, when the show comes on, that's not actually Stratford, but the Bob Newhart show was essentially kind of created around the idea of a town like Stratford. In the show, I think it's actually Stratford. But Stratford, they visited there quite often. So that's what you're envisioning, okay, except for Larry, Daryl, and Daryl. This is looking down from the hillside on the little town. You can just sort of see it's a town. One of the things the students are impressed with when we go there, and they're all amazed by this, is, you know, they grew up here in the West where we have everything in grids. And there's always streets and blocks and houses are everywhere and towns are towns. And you drive through Maine and then first and third and fifth. And in the homestead area where Morrill grew up, there's one road that just sort of winds up through the hills of Vermont along the river. And there's a house here and a house there, and maybe a post office, then another house. And this thing may be 10, 15 miles long, but that's the town of all these small little connections. So it's a very rural area, lots of farms, lots of rural people at the time milling around making their living in Vermont. Morrill was born and raised in this home, which still stands in Stratford. His father, Nathaniel, and his mother, Mary, had 10 children, of which Morrill was the second born. The family lost 5 before they were adults. So Morrill and his family went through some hardship. They lived in this community of farmers and very agrarian people. And Morrill's education began as a young boy reading the Bible and going to church, and his mother educated him in the Bible. He was particularly fond of the book of Job. Now we know why he spent 5 years working on a land-grant college act. Okay? Morrill was educated essentially in elementary schools up through what would then be junior high school. He spent 3 months at the Randolph Academy, which was equivalent to high school, and this ended his formal education. Okay? We'll come back to that in a second. His father owned a blacksmith shop. This is the blacksmith shop. It's now a house, but at one point in time, this would have been the blacksmith shop, same building. There would have been a large mill. The stream flows right here to the right of this building, and there would have been a sluiceway that brought the water in to power the engines, the blacksmith shop. This is the Ompompanoosic River. There's one to say real fast. Okay. And you can still see the wall where the water was diverted, and some of the things are there. But he grew up in the blacksmith shop. His father made a good business out of making shovels, picks, hoes, and the various implements that farmers would use. So it's not so much, I mean, he did horseshoes and things like that, but it really wasn't the blacksmith shop we sometimes think of from TV, where they're building swords and, you know, the big-time equipment and all this. He was basically making implements and selling them. And so the farmers would come and go, and Morrill met them all working in the blacksmith shop and got to know the people and feel a part of their lives and was part of the community. And again, education-wise, Randolph Academy last time. And one day he came into the blacksmith shop and he asked his father, he said, "Daddy, I want to go to college." And his father looked at him and he said, "Son, I could afford to send you, but if I do, I can't send your brothers or sisters." Morrill opted not to go to college. Now, Morrill was offered the chance to teach at a local school, but turned it down. And a mentor entered his life that had been a friend of the family. Jedediah Hyde Harris was one of the local businessmen, took Morrill under his wing, and began to mentor and shepherd him, and he encouraged him to go into business and work with him work in a store and develop his business pursuits. So Morrill left his dream of a formal education at that point and moved into the realm of self-teaching and teaching himself as he went along, learning by reading books. Morrill's first job was in Harris's store. He would later go on to Maine for a short time, where he learned the trade and accounting and did some other bookkeeping. He was a very good person at the double entry method of bookkeeping. So when he returned back to Stratford once to visit family, a person had passed away, and so he agreed to stay on and work in the store and become part of the partnership with Harris. And there was a partnership with Harris and Morrill, then later it would become, I think, Morrill Young would formally have their own partnership. But they worked in this store, which is now the post office in Stratford. You can still see the shelves on the wall where Morrill would go in and take things from it, so it's, to me, very inspiring. But he learned the business trade. Now, if you didn't know this back in this time, this was the political center of everything in the town of Stratford. Farmers came and went, politicians came and went, businessmen came and went. They talked about politics, they talked about the war, they talked about law, they talked about government, they talked about everything. And Morrill educated himself in the various arts and sciences and literature by reading as well as listening to conversations in the store throughout his life. He became a very good businessman. And in fact, he's most well known in Congress by congressional means or congressional circles at the time not so much for the Morrill Act, but for his work with tariffs. He was an excellent businessman and was very strongly involved in the tariff process as well as funding the war, and he would later go on to create what we would know as the IRS, but we won't hold that against him. Okay? So that was where he was educated. Now, Morrill loved books, and he began to collect books. He even started a library fund. Remember, this is a young, he's a young man. I realize 18 and 19-year-old, 20-year-old boys back then are a lot more mature than they are today, but this man basically created a library club where they would save their money and they would buy books and they would swap books and trade books, and he began to amass this massive library. He read constantly, and he taught himself literature, art, sciences, architecture, agriculture. Okay, very much a self-taught man. And eventually he would donate those books to this, what become this would be the town library. It's since been moved over here to a memorial library named in his honor that contains his book collection as well as the town's books, and this became a clerk's office. But this was a donation he made to the city to basically give his book collection. So Morrill taught himself everything he knew. He also spent a lot of time in this building, which is the townhouse. This is the most photographed building in Vermont. This is where the politicians would discuss issues. They would go for protests. They would have town meetings. Morrill was there. His name is carved, and as some of his family members are carved in the benches up in the upstairs part of this, where he sat as a boy and listened to these discussions and conversations. So he learned all he needed to know about being a congressman and a senator in this small building on a hill in Stratford, Vermont. Now, my favorite part comes right here. Okay, in 1848, Morrill was 38 years old. I turned 49 a few weeks ago. At 38, he sold his business and had a fortune of about $30,000, which would be quite a bit in today's dollars, in case you're not familiar with the math change. But so he's a very wealthy man at age 38. He retired at 38. I got 70, 18 more years before I can retire. And he became a gentleman farmer. How many people do you know sold their business and retired to become a farmer? Not going to happen in today's day and age, right? But that's what Morrill wanted to do. He was fascinated with agriculture. He was fascinated with horticulture. He had been reading books on planting and looking at breeding and other things. So he retired to become a farmer. But he continued his self-education. He still bought books. He still collected books. And he attended any chance he could to learn. He was into that stuff a bit. He became more politically active at this point in his career, started working with the Whig Party locally, and throughout the 40s and 50s he would be a part of the Whig Party. Ultimately then, when the Whig Party went through its upheaval, he would be a Republican, and thus he would come to be on the side of Lincoln at the time of the signing. But he built this house. He went and had been reading books on Gothic architecture and looking at the way cottages were built and things like that, and he taught himself some architecture, and he decided he wanted to have a Gothic revival house in the middle of New England. So he built this home, drew up the plans, built, I'm sure somebody else helped him with carpentry, but he built the home after he designed it, built this thing, and then they painted it pink. It doesn't show up as well here, but this is a really interesting, hideous pink because it looked like sandstone. In fact, there's actually some sand stipple in the original paint. They don't do that now for weather control reasons, but so he wanted a house that looked sandstone because the Gothic revival houses at the time were sandstone, and this was his house. And within this house, he again would read, and later he would entertain when he was in Congress, and this would be his home till the day he died. He also had another home in Washington where he did spend more time near the end of his life, but this home is still preserved. You can tour this house. Anyone been to this house? You can go to the house and go through. You can see Morrill's desk with his books on it, the papers he worked. You can see, if you're really special, they take you up in the special library above the carriage house where all the congressional papers are, including a book on agriculture in Nebraska and including Hayden's work on surveying the western United States. So a lot of things I like as a geologist I find up there and I'm like, wow, this guy was reading. He has what was the modern equivalent, or I mean the 1800s equivalent of an easy chair, and his glasses are sitting there, and all this has been preserved, just sort of left after they passed away. The house has been occupied by a few people since, but they didn't do anything with it. So it's a wonderful place to go and visit if you want to know more about Justin Morrill. Anyway, I digress. So here's a man living in a small rural community surrounded by farmers, no education of his own, had to be self-taught, and they decide to send him to Congress. So it's obvious that when this man comes up to Congress, he's going to have an interest and a passion when people are starting to talk about education. And the reason this Morrill Act was there, I believe, is not so much because of all the discussions and the comments going on across the nation. It was because one man took it personal and said, I grew up in an area where I didn't have an education. I know what the farmers are. I know what they think about. And I know if we talk to these people, they could plow better, they could plant better, they could grow crops, they could make their soil more renewed with its nutrients, and we could teach these people how to be better farmers and make the same kind of advances that they've made in Europe. So his inspiration, as his biographer said, came from the small village, his town, his house, and the people he lived with. Just to show you, Morrill wasn't a farmer. These are modern, but Morrill planted extensive gardens and orchards behind his house. There are, I believe, 6 barns on the property for cows, horses, sheep, etc., chickens. But this was this has been replanted by the homestead folks now that run the place. But this was his kitchen garden. There's an orchard up on the right. So Morrill began to practice with breeding different plants. He brought in trees and plants from all around the world to get them to grow, and there's all kinds of varieties of things here. I heard mentioned earlier of the ice cream that we have on campus. There's a Morrill Orchard Medley ice cream that I helped design. I'm very proud of it, actually. But it came from the idea that Morrill had all these things on his property. So we put those into the ice cream to try to make it like it was something he might have created. This is the library inside the house to show you his book collection. This is a portion of it. There are more of these out in the main education building now and more up in his other study over the carriage house. But Morrill filled his library with books, and he read them. Okay, I have a big library in my basement, too, but I haven't read anywhere near all the books because I'm one of those guys who thinks that, you know, if you have a lot of books, you look cool and people come over to visit. But I've read a lot of them. But Morrill read them all. They're all dog-eared pages. They have underlining and markings in them. They all have little things in them where he made notes. It's a very impressive collection on geology, botany, agronomy, horticulture, plant breeding, architecture, music, literature, art, everything is there. Self-educated man. And here he is sitting in his study, one of my favorite pictures. This is near the end of his life. Okay. Morrill was indeed a lifelong learner, and even after the Land-Grant Act was passed, he continued to read, he continued to learn. He would spend hours in his carriage over study reading the documents from the congressional amounts. There are crates there that were shipped from D.C. with all the documents in them that he had to read and go through when he was home on vacation. He spent a great deal of time reading and teaching himself all the issues that he wanted to work on. He would go learn about them, then he would become involved in them in Congress, including at the end of his life, which I'll hint at it here in a minute. He was also very widely known as the person who beautified Washington, D.C. Many of the buildings you see, many of the paintings and artwork in the Capitol building, Morrill had a hand in that he selected the artists to do the work. The artists often came to his house in Vermont and left the little pictures that they were going to use for the big pictures in D.C. So there's a lot of the artwork is in the house in Vermont that you see in D.C. It was a pretty impressive thing. So I probably went way too long on Morrill, but he's the guy I'm really inspired by. He was elected to the Senate in 1866, so he moved on to serve in the Senate after he served in the House. And it was in the Senate that he passed the 1890 Act. Between 1870 and 1890, he brought forward 7 different bills to try to aid the land grants. So even after he created them in 1862, he kept coming forward with new bills trying to get money to keep them going. They were his passion. They mattered to him more than anything else he did in life. At least that's what we get from his records, his letters, and biography. Second Morrill Act was passed in 1890. I've already hinted at what that was for. Morrill died on December 28th of 1898. And on his death, the country wept. Congress celebrated. There were speeches and parades and memorials. The man had impacted a lot of people in that day and age, and he was greatly respected. And when he died, he had served longer than any person in Congress for 43 years. Now, he's since that record has been eclipsed in recent years, but he was one of the longest-serving members for a great deal of time. Dedicated his life to public service. So one of the other things that I use this example for with my students is to talk about not only the lifelong learning, to talk about stubbornness and considering to have a passion about something, but also the idea of a lifelong commitment to service. Okay, and I believe, even though it's not stated such in the Act, Morrill believed that by educating people and training them, that it would be easier for them to commit themselves to serving others. And the colleges themselves, to me, have that air about their creation, that they were there to serve the public, to serve the people of those states, to serve the citizens in teaching them and educating them. So despite the fact that it didn't come till later that we created some of the survey components of this, I think it was there in its initial inception with his thoughts. Back to my last questions. I hope you've answered these with what I've said. If not, then I've failed. But what inspired this new system, I think, came from the fact that the young boy in the blacksmith shop was told, you can't go to college. And he spent the rest of his life teaching himself and realizing when he got in a position to make a difference, he could. And he could make sure that the rest of us all had an opportunity to have that education if we wanted it. And at the time of the Civil War, Morrill doesn't talk a lot about it. Morrill was very concerned in his diaries. He mentions this in his notes as well. He was worried that the Union would never get back together. But he was very frustrated with the whole process of splitting, and he worked very hard while he was in the Congress to try to find ways on committees to get the South to come back and to get things to work out. And they tried to work out various compromises, but to no avail. And I believe Morrill thought, and he's mentioned this in a couple places, I guess, but Morrill felt that one way when the country came back together, or one way to bring the country back together, was to educate the populace. And I think at the time when the country was ripping itself to shreds, or beginning to, Morrill and the other congressmen had the foresight to actually pass an act that would wholly heal the nation eventually by bringing us together in terms of the system of education and setting up something new and powerful that had never been done before. So And in doing so, I think he really meant this to be important. He added this to the second one, and I think it's an important part of the moral act, as I said, that we should never forget. We're not just about ag, we're not just about engineering, we're about educating Americans, okay, so they can pursue the professions of life. I'll end with this. I think there's maybe one more after this. But Morrill died, and it's kind of interesting when you tour Stratford, you walk around the town, you get a real sense of humility, you get a sense that Morrill was a humble man, though he's a very proud man in the sense that he was proud of his accomplishments. No reference is ever made of him being arrogant or pompous or pedantic in any way. But when he died, his son and his sister-in-law felt it very important that people remember Morrill, so they built this mausoleum and buried the family in it. There's some evidence that Morrill knew about it, but one biographer states that they did it, and the other, I've read elsewhere that Morrill sort of had started the planning early on. But this monument sits up on top of the hill. The entire Morrill family is buried here. It's in a small cemetery in Stratford that looks out over Stratford, and what's funny about it is at the time it was built, you would have been able to see it for miles. It would have been the largest monument up there. Everyone would say, who's that? What's that all about? Oh, that's Justin Morrill. Today, there are trees growing up all around the edges that you can't even see the thing unless you're right on top of it. And when you stand up on the hill, you look out over it, you can still see a little bit. But this is pretty much obscured from the public eye. And so you'd never know it was there if you didn't know to look for it. So the irony to me is that the man who built this monument to say, who's that on the hill, Justin Morrill, is actually more remembered by what he did in life to help the rest of us than what he did in life and put it into a monument. Okay. One of the other things I teach my students when we go there is to build your monuments not out of stone. This will sound biblical, and I don't mean it to. Build your monuments not out of money and stone, but build them out of the deeds and the things you do that benefit and change the lives of others. And I think another part of the Land Grant University mission, as I see it, as I wax poetic and philosophical, is that we are to change the lives of the people we encounter. The students that come to our doors should leave changed because they came to a Land Grant University. And this is Morrill's quote that I like very much. We've actually used a portion of this as our logo. That asking personally for nothing, I trust it may be believed that I have aimed only to promote the greatest good for the greatest number. And as a faculty member for me at the University of Nebraska, this is something I've taken very personal as my own mission, that I'm here to promote the greatest good for my students and to make them better people. And the rest of it's baloney as far as I'm concerned. But, okay, so there we go. If you're interested, I am now concluding my talk. If you're interested, there are some resources. There are a lot of resources out there, but two that I find particularly fun to read and easy to read. The first is a book about land grants called The Magnificent Charter. This is out of print, but you can still get it in the library. It's a very simple, easy, readable book that gives you good background on the land grant colleges. There's also one recently been put out by the Research Council. The National Board deals with agricultural colleges. If you're interested in learning about Morrill, the biography that's still available through, I believe it's Michigan State Press, is The Justin Morrill, Father of Land Grant Colleges by Coy Cross. Coy and I have become good friends over the years, and he's a really interesting man who found all kinds of interesting papers and notes. And when Coy wrote the book, there had been a biography already written. The family essentially authorized the first one. Belmont Parker, William Belmont Parker, wrote the first one. And the family sort of wanted to hide any negative things about Morrill. Not that there were negative things, but there's really no stories about frailty or failure or frustration. It's all, yay, yay, rah, rah, go Morrill, here I, you know. And so Coy was interested in learning more about the personality of the man. And he was able to come across some literature and some papers and diaries and things when he did his research that no one else knew about. They learned about Ruth, Morrill's wife, had epilepsy, for example, was never mentioned in the biography. So there's some other things, not to besmirch Morrill, but this lets you get to know the personal side, the man. Okay, so those are both available, and you can get this one as well as the other one in the library, but this one you can buy online, and I would recommend them. Okay, that's all I have. I hope this was what you came to hear. I can tell you that Morrill is a very inspiring man, and the Morrill Act is as well, but when you learn about Justin Morrill, you begin to understand what the Morrill Act is really all about, and I think for me, anyway, it changed the way I view my job as a faculty member here, as well as it changed what I think the mission of land-grant universities are. So if I had one comment to make philosophically about where I think the land grant should go, I've thought a lot about this. I mean, we hear a lot of speeches and a lot of university presidents talk about the next land grant act in the future and what we're going to do with public education in America and all our problems and how we have to change it. But I think the simplest and easiest act that we can do is to educate our own faculty and staff as to what the mission of the land grant university is. We hire a lot of new people who don't know what a land grant is. Young guys who are right out of school, they're eager, ready to go, they're all fired up and geared to do research and publish those papers, but they just don't get it. And I think we have some administrators that do the same thing. And again, I'm not trying to be negative. I certainly don't want to be fired tomorrow because I said this, but I think it's important that we reinstill in our faculty and in our students and in our people the real mission of this land-grant university. It's about service. It's about serving the state, serving the citizens, to educate that industrial class to those pursuits of life. Okay? So that's where I think the land grant should go. It's an easy thing we can all do internally without a lot of congressional acts, without a lot of money, without a lot of discussion, debate. Each one of us can rechart our own course. Well, I thank you for coming. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be happy to answer questions if we have time. I may not know all the answers if you get too detailed because, as I said, it's my hobby, not my career.
So thank you very much. I think we can begin to understand why he inspires his students so much, that in fact they want to take what he calls a pilgrimage, we might think of it as a field trip, to do service learning work in Vermont each summer. And I just congratulate Ed for doing that.